Welcome to Taiwan Context. I'm Donovan Smith. All right, now a lot of people have been commenting online about the bilingual nation by 2030 plan from the government. And pretty much nobody knows really much of what it actually is all about, including myself. So today we have in studio Jenna Lynn Cody, who actually knows quite a bit about this. So what's your connection to this?
Hi, yeah, a couple of different things. In my work, my main work now is teacher training, and through one of the people that I work for, I have been delivering EMI, that's English as a Medium of Instruction modules, to university professors through a program aimed at helping basically have more English language courses and programs offered at the university level in Taiwan as an offshoot of this program. It hasn't really had a forward momentum yet, but there is a project afoot to do some basic research into, at the university level, what do universities need in order to implement these programs? What do lecturers want? What do students want? What's lacking? How do their programs, which are in English, mesh with their English proficiency requirements and the coursework for foreign language? And so they were looking into how to research that. That's just getting off the ground now, so I can only really speak in generalities on that. But
you're familiar with the plans.
Yes, very right. Familiar with the plans. And there's also a lot of talk about how this will affect K through 12, so elementary, junior high, and high school. And I have been working with a lot of Taiwanese school teachers who voluntarily sign up for courses training them in the methodology of EMI, English as a Medium of Instruction, for the potential to offer some of their own courses. These are not English teachers. These are math teachers, science teachers, art teachers, sometimes English teachers, just to learn how it's done, what's the methodology behind it, so that if this comes to pass, they'll have some good foundational knowledge of how to run their courses. Through that, I've spent a lot of time with people that work much harder than I do on the program. So I'm involved in a nominal way. I'm there. I'm doing my thing. And I talk to a lot of other people who are much more deeply involved. And as a result, I've come to know a lot about what's behind it, what are the intentions behind it, that kind of thing. I've also referenced it a lot in my dissertation. So I just finished my master's at the University of Exeter, and my focus was intercultural communication in teacher training. I did qualitative research interviewing 6 teacher trainers, 3 foreign, 3 local. And because so many of these English proficiency improvement plans through history in Taiwan have had some component where they say they want to focus on intercultural communication, intercultural competence, this program was a big part of what I talked to them about. So I would be referencing a lot of that research when I answer this.
All right. So why don't we kick off with, what is Bilingual Nation by 2030? What are the basic plans for this?
The basic plans are a multi-pronged approach where on one end, they want to improve the investment climate in Taiwan by making the ability to access needed government services and paperwork in English more accessible to foreigners who might want to come here and work or start a business. The tourism front, so they want to make Taiwan a more accessible place in English for tourists. Not just improving signage, but to give an example, the week before last, I was in Tainan, and I ended up in a small temple in Xuejia, which is about an hour north of Tainan City, which has all of this immensely valuable pottery sculpture work that was all from the 19th century. And when they did the renovation of the temple, they moved all of that to an exhibition hall. And there is just a lovely bilingual introduction and bilingual guide to the whole thing. Had that not been there, it would have been quite limited what I could have learned about that art form. So the fact that Tainan managed to do that, that's the sort of thing they want to do across the whole country. Contrast that with, I went to Jiayi recently, and I went to the cultural center up on the hill in the old Japanese shrine, and there was no English whatsoever. So I do read Chinese. I'm fairly slow. I don't like to get in people's way by sitting there and reading line by line. So all I can really do is take a look around, and skim a little bit of what's there. The experiences were very different. So they want to improve that and make sure that these cultural heritage sites are more accessible in English. Mm-hmm. Government websites, they want to ensure that any information foreigners may need from the government is available to them online to the same level that it is accessible in Mandarin. Then finally, and probably the most controversial part of the plan, is to improve English language education. And there are a couple of ways they want to do this. First is, there is something in the plan that specifically references wanting to improve the way current English classes are conducted, and does, I think, very in passing mention the proficiency and testing system. Although, I mean, I would have to find the exact quote. Let's see, relaxing related enrollment regulations, feasible models for integrating English into preschool caretaking activities, Englishized learning environment, flexible mechanisms so new models can be created. And they want to do that mostly through something called CLIL, Content in Language Integrated Learning.
Okay, we'll get to that topic in a minute.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so that's what the plan is for.
Yes.
Now, what does it not address? What isn't this program?
Okay, well, let me talk a bit first about what's good about this program.
Okay.
So there are some really good things in it, and I think that this is what a lot of people miss when they comment on it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, and this is partly poor branding, which I'd like to talk about later, but a lot of people assume that the program means to prioritize English over local languages and mother tongue languages. So we're talking about not just Taiwanese, but indigenous languages, Hakka, and also the mother tongue languages of other immigrants. So Indonesian, Tagalog, Vietnamese, and just shove them all out of the way and make it English, English, English.
The Hangul plan.
Pretty much. Now, the nice thing about this plan is that if you actually read it, it says the exact opposite. So it says that side by side with implementation of the bilingual nation policy, equal importance will also be attached to the promotion of native language culture. Taiwan in the future will be a nation of diverse ethnicities and languages. It already is, but let's let that be. The bilingual policy will be parallel to the pluralistic development of mother tongues, and its implementation will not constrain native language education. That sounds wonderful, and a lot of people miss that and think that they're just pushing native language education to the side. There is a discussion to be had over how well that will actually be implemented, but the intentions are there, the knowledge is there, the understanding that it's easy to ignore other languages in favor of English is there. So that's something that's good about it. I would say that of all of the plans the government has had in the past to develop the foreign language proficiency in Taiwan, that this is probably the most enlightened. It's also the most ambitious. I am not sure they will meet all of their ambitions, but if implemented in a principled way, I think they can get a lot closer than people imagine. So that's basically what's good about the plan. Another thing that's really nice about it is that it does specifically reference that they want to get buy-in from the teachers and the students. So their idea is that teachers will voluntarily offer their course in English, or they will provide funding for schools, and those courses will come out because people want to take them and teachers are willing to offer them. So there was explicitly no intention to force kids to take, say, math class in English. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So those are some things that are actually very nice about the plan. Mm-hmm. There is a goal to talk to lecturers and schools and see what they need and actually gather research, gather data on what's needed before full implementation, which is a very enlightened and thoughtful way of going about it. And that's sort of the part where I'm involved now, although it's not really gotten off the ground yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, there's something you referred to earlier in the show, which is CLIL.
Yes.
Can you clearly explain that?
Sure. CLIL, Content and Language Integrated Learning. The easy explanation is teaching subject classes in English, but that's not really all it is. So CLIL actually requires a fair amount of methodological and process and knowledge to implement effectively. So let's say you've got a science class and you want to teach that science class in English to maybe a mixture of students, maybe all non-native speakers, maybe some native, most non-native. But you have to have certain ways of doing that where you can't just go in and deliver your science lecture in English. That won't work. The students won't understand. It will be boring for them. And it will be stressful for you because you are probably a non-native teacher. Right. So
that sounds like a great combination. Go in, don't understand, to be bored all at once.
Yes, it's terrible. What you actually do is you really center these communicative approaches. What has been shown to be consistently successful is peer teaching, so that students who struggle, whether in the content or in the language, learn more and learn better from peers who are stronger, who understand, who are helping them than they do from the teacher. Because the students are all learning together, even though some are stronger than others. The teacher is coming from a place of already having all of this knowledge. And when you are imparting knowledge you know deeply, it's very easy to over or underestimate what the other person knows or their language proficiency in attaining it. Mm-hmm. So basically, more group work, more teamwork, more peer teaching. Evidence also shows that this benefits the stronger students, because the way you really learn something is not by listening to the teacher, although you can, but by teaching it to someone else. Mm-hmm. So you have understood what the teacher has imparted on you through an interactive way, hopefully not through a lecture. A lot of what we do is basically convincing teachers you don't need to lecture, and then working with either other stronger students to bolster your knowledge, or with weaker students in a tutor or mentor role, where you help them understand what they're not grasping. And there are so many studies on this, just routinely shows that it works. And it gets everybody speaking and using English, possibly with some Chinese thrown in. So the other thing that a lot of people get wrong is that a class taught in English doesn't necessarily mean everything that happens in that class happens in English. Among language teachers in the know, judicious use of the, assuming that students all share a native language, right, which we call an L1, a term I might use later. Judicious use of that to explain a term that has a direct translation, to get the weaker students on board, to clarify a point quickly, or through something called translanguaging, which is when the end product has to be in the L2. That's the language being learned. So English in this case. The end product has to be in English, but the way you get there can include use of your L1, of your native language. So students could potentially hold their discussion in English with a little Chinese as needed, or use Chinese to look up information in English, but the final output, the project, the portfolio, the presentation, the diorama, whatever, would be in English. Mm-hmm. And then the whole class discussion would be in English. And that's considered a valid way to learn. This idea that no Chinese, no Mandarin, whatever, can be allowed in the classroom once it's in English is false, or should be false. And a lot of people don't realize that the dichotomy is not that clear.
Actually, years ago, I was a teacher back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And that's basically how I taught children. Is I structured the whole class around games and activities, and stronger kids would teach the weaker kids. They could use Chinese to explain something to each other. So yeah, I set up my classes basically on those principles. I'd never heard of that before, but but you know, I came to that through my own experience. So
exactly. It incorporates a lot of something called learner autonomy. Learners setting goals for themselves and then figuring out how to achieve them, with the teacher as more of a facilitator rather than a lecturer, which takes the pressure off the teachers as well, because they don't have to prepare a lecture in English, or they don't have to get students to read chorally in lockstep from textbooks in English, which is boring and they probably won't understand it.
Right.
A lot of our work is on how to implement task-based learning. So whether or not you've learned the topic or learned the subject is judged by your successful completion of a task. learn about the solar system, you know, create a diorama and present it. And your ability to present it shows that you have learned about the solar system. And it's done in English. Content is usually king. English, like the language, is secondary. So what language may be focused on is decided by the content. Right. So content is not meant to suffer at all. Whether or not content does suffer does go back to the ability or the knowledge base of the teacher, which is something I'd also like to talk about more later on. Okay. Also, the importance of scaffolding, where you know there are certain words, terms, chunks, phrases that the learners will need to know to understand the topic in English. So you find scaffolded ways to introduce those, make them comprehensible, and then move on to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. So kind of how to do that, not just jumping in and, hey kids, it's the solar system in English. It's a lot more methodologically sound than people give it credit for.
Okay.
There's been a lot of research on this, and generally it's shown to be successful. So a lot of the criticisms I have seen about this program is, well, why should we have to do math and art class in English? You know, in Europe, they don't do that and they speak English well. Yes, they have more English in their daily life, right? They don't need to do that. But also a lot of people believe that language can only be learned fluently under a certain age. It's called the critical period hypothesis.
Yeah, that's not true.
It's not true at all. It has pretty much, it's hard to say proven, nothing's ever proven, but evidence shows that kids learn language faster than adults because they have more free time to practice.
Yeah.
They're more likely to be in an immersive environment than an adult. An adult is more likely to go to a language class twice a week for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And a kid might go to an English kindy or have a family who speaks a lot of English. Of course, they'll pick it up. Mm-hmm. The only evidence that there is anything to the age requirement to learn a language is maybe weak evidence that it could impact pronunciation.
Right.
The good news is that doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading before that something that I think actually is quite true. And my own experience is that adults can learn the language faster if they have the same amount of time, because the concepts behind a lot of language are already there.
Yeah.
In other words, if you teach a kid a new word, but they don't know that word in their native language, then you have to explain all the concepts behind it.
Yeah.
Whereas an adult already has a conceptual framework on science or a whole range of topics where you can give them a word and they'll go, they already understand all the concepts behind it, whereas kids generally don't.
Exactly. Back when I taught kids, I had that experience trying to teach the word spy, and my 7-year-olds didn't even know what that was in Chinese.
Right.
So I had to drop it. I didn't try to explain, I just dropped it.
Right.
Yeah, again, research shows adults can focus on form. Mm-hmm. You can explain grammar a little bit more. With kids, trying to explain grammar rules simply does not work.
Right.
And when we work with our K-12 teachers, this is one thing that we talk about, how visualizations, demonstrations, acting it out, seeing it in contextualization is really the key to getting them to catch the grammar.
Right.
And that has a lot of basis in different methodologies which are popular in modern language teaching. Mm-hmm. Adults can spend a little more time asking about form, but what they really need is a more, and when I say adults, I include teenagers and older children in that.
Okay.
A more immersive environment, and that's what CLIL provides.
Okay. Now, here's an interesting just side note.
Okay.
If this had been the martial law era, those kids would have all known the word spy.
That is a fair point. Yes. In English and Chinese, probably.
Yes.
Yes. Definitely, for sure. What's interesting to me about this is that it references buy-in, getting teachers on board. The development plan is very much wanting people to, you know, proactively engage with it. And what that means is nobody is going to be forced, well, according to the plan, nobody is going to be forced to take these classes in English.
Okay.
They will be there, but they will not be like, hey, little Johnny, you have to take it. Or Ms. Chen, you have to teach this. Mm-hmm. One criticism, however, to what extent is buy-in truly buy-in?
Right.
In my experience, I have a lot of experience training up these teachers. They do want to be there. They sign up because they want to see what this is all about and potentially offer their courses in English. Or if they're English teachers, maybe how to deliver their courses better in this new framework. And most of them are already very good. They've actually got a great conceptual background about how to teach language effectively. The question becomes, what about the teachers who don't want to buy in? At what point do schools wanting to get funding say,
right,
we need buy-in, so you are going to buy in? And that is a question, and that's something that I think we need to hold them accountable on and keep an eye on to make sure that that does not happen.
Right. And of course, with the kids, they may be under pressure from their parents, so they may not be buying in on their own.
Kids rarely buy into their own schooling, no matter what language it's in. So
that's a good point, yes. But there is polling I've seen in Taiwan, which suggests that English learning is the least popular subject.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Given the fact that I think the messaging on this has not been great, regarding this program specifically, that doesn't surprise me. I also think that we really do need to be letting people decide for themselves whether they need English or not. Mm-hmm. That's another criticism I have of criticisms of this program. A lot of people seem to have their own ideas about who does and does not need English. Mm-hmm. I agree, some people need it and some people don't. I do not agree with other people deciding who they are. Some of the most interesting, occasionally unlikely people become activists, spokespeople. They want to get their message out. They want to talk to the international community. And if it's preemptively decided, well, they don't really need English. Mm-hmm. We should focus on only mother tongue for them. Most Taiwanese don't need English. They don't need it. You've pretty much clipped that kid's wings before they could ever decide for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two comments on that. One is, when you study another language, you learn a whole new set of concepts and a way of thinking. So it broadens the mind. I'll give you another example is, why do we study trigonometry and algebra when we never use it?
Yeah.
Because it teaches us logic. It teaches us a way of proceeding rationally.
Yeah.
So it's great for training the brain, even if you end up never using it.
I think
there's a case to be made for learning another language.
There is.
Even if they end up not using it.
Yes. Well, a lot of people also criticize Bilingual by 2030 and English programs for that reason, where learning a language inherently does mean learning about the cultural concepts, way of thinking, kind of worldview of that language. Now, a lot of people think that means it will detract from someone's own local culture. In the past, there was very much this belief you can't teach the language without teaching the culture. Very interesting participant on my dissertation told a really good story about this that I'd like to impart, where he said that 30 years ago, you were teaching English in Japan. You had to, or it was considered that, oh, you're going to teach active listening. In English, people listen actively. That's how we show we're listening. We go, In Japanese, the way you show that you are being attentive is by not saying anything because you're quietly listening. And so they thought we have to teach them. But in English, you go, and that's what they learn. And that's what you have to teach them. And now that's really flipped, where the idea is make learners aware of that cultural content. In English, English speakers tend to use active listening. But you can use English however you see fit. So if you are speaking English to a Taiwanese person, a Korean, someone from anywhere else, you don't necessarily have to follow the American or native speaker or British or whatever cultural pathways that are typically associated with a language.
Okay.
So make them aware of the difference. Don't force the difference on them. We do this in Taiwan when I teach business writing. I teach Dear All is quite acceptable for a diverse group of people you're writing to. Students come to me and say, yeah, but one of the people is a senior VP. And then there's a team. And then there's another VP from another company. If I say Dear All, I'm not respecting their position. And I say, okay, in English, people probably wouldn't worry too much about that. But if from a cultural perspective, you want to acknowledge that hierarchy, you can say, Dear Vice President Lin, Dear Director Huang and team, and hello team. If you want to make a longer greeting, you can do that because that's important to you. Mm-hmm. So making people aware of the differences while not forcing the differences on them.
Okay.
So yeah, you do. And when you look at the world in a language, whatever language that is, you do see it in a different way. And as another very interesting participant on my dissertation said, the more languages you give people, it's like the more windows you're giving them in their house. Mm-hmm. If you are Taiwanese and your mother is Atayal, and you speak Tayu and you speak Mandarin and you learn Atayal because it's your mother's language, because these are all promoted, and you learn English so you can talk to the wider world, and you learn a few phrases in Indonesian because your grandma's care worker speaks Indonesian and you want to welcome her, that's wonderful. You don't have to do that to the detriment of your own culture. Culture not even being a static thing. It gives you all these different tools to connect with the world. You can connect with your grandma's caretaker, your mother's Atayal family, Taiwan and Taiwanese, and then Mandarin as well, and then English. There's so many different ways to connect, and you can see the world almost through a kaleidoscope rather than a magnifying glass. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Rather than looking through a toilet paper roll, like I look at my cats, you can look at it. You have a solarium through which to see the world, and you're just given all of these tools. Mm-hmm. And as long as you are trained as an aware individual, mm-hmm. and you make your own decisions, again, learner autonomy, about how and when to use these languages, it doesn't have to be to the detriment of anything.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That kind of segues into why, or what is the case that they're making for teaching English in Taiwan?
That's a very interesting question. And a big part of the recommendations actually on my dissertation went into this, that the case they're making is to make Taiwan more internationally accessible. That's why they're focusing on businesses, government websites, tourism, which makes sense. You want the people that are on the front lines and actually have to use English to communicate to be the ones getting the brunt of this push, right? Here's a case I would make. Unlike other countries, Taiwan needs to connect with the rest of the world. If we localize, get in our shell, only focus on mother tongue, only Tayu, indigenous languages, Hakka are important, and English is this foreign thing with no connection to us, it makes it harder for Taiwanese to talk about their country to people from around the world and not just Westerners. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at the Milk Tea Alliance. I don't know if you follow any of their Facebook pages, their hashtags.
Yeah, I'm aware of it.
I follow. Mm-hmm. So one interesting thing is that they're all communicating in English.
Yeah.
So Thailand, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, India, all these people in the Milk Tea Alliance communicate in English with each other. The memes are in English.
Yeah.
Often there are errors in them, like grammatical errors. It doesn't matter because mm-hmm. these are not intended for native speakers,
yeah.
right? So in order to communicate with other activists across Asia, English is used. So Taiwanese who want to engage in that mm-hmm. need that if they want to join that sort of conversation.
Yeah.
The same can be said of the Network of Young Democratic Asians, NYDA. For my dissertation, I talked to one of the founders of that, asking him about the languages they used to talk to the other young democratic Asians. Mm-hmm. They have members across Asia, right?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, when we're talking to the Hong Kongers, typically we use Mandarin because we all speak Mandarin.
Right.
To varying degrees, but we all speak it. But when we're talking to Vietnamese, Thai, anyone else, it switches to English. So we do need English.
Yeah.
So just to talk to other Asians about, you know, these issues that affect the entire region, mostly about Chinese hegemony, mm-hmm. which has a lot to do with Mandarin language supremacy, which also feeds into this. Mm-hmm. There is a good case to be made that Taiwan, it doesn't need it to get in touch with its own cultural roots. It needs it to expand and talk to the rest of the world.
Right. I mean, I've explained to people before, there's basically two different kinds of English.
Yeah.
And there's an international English.
Yeah.
Which
there's
has
more than
simplified,
one, but yes.
Yeah. But I mean, basically there's kind of a simplified grammar which people use in business to communicate mm-hmm. with each other. It doesn't need to be native level for communication purposes.
Yeah.
If you're going to be writing for a newspaper in the US, you're going to need one level of English.
Yeah.
If you want to do business with somebody in Germany or in Pakistan, you're not going to need that level of English.
No, you're going to need to communicate with them in a way that they understand, which includes not only comprehensibility, but you want to have some competence to know, like, what type of tone, what's an appropriate tone to address them with, like direct, indirect, formal, like what kind of tone are they expecting? Sure. And that's the sort of thing you can teach in class. Like if you're talking to someone from Pakistan, if you're talking to someone from Germany, there's many terms for that. World Englishes, English as an international language and English as a lingua franca.
Yeah, I've heard of variety.
People,
of terms, yeah.
People use English to communicate with non-native speakers far more frequently than with native speakers. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would gather most Taiwanese are using it for.
Yeah.
Interestingly, another participant, a Taiwanese, on my dissertation, a lot of what she talked about when she talked about why we need English was focused on talking to native speakers. Oh, they can communicate with British, Americans, Canadians. And then I asked her, how about communicating in Taiwan with Indonesians, Filipinos, Vietnamese, Thai? And she's like, oh yeah, we do that too. And maybe we do that more. And I'm like, do you think you do that more? Yes, you know. So there is this acknowledgement that when I go to Japan, I use English. When I go to Korea, I use English. So yeah, it's not about always facing the West. Very interesting scholar, Amar Mahbub. I would have to look up his exact name. Well, the problem is that I'm having issues with my... Here we go. Let me get this pages 1 to 230. I'm trying to find my bibliography. Ah, okay. Mahbub A. Great. that's helpful.
That A part was hard to remember.
Let's call him Mahbub. He, I believe it's Omar, but he talked about basically decentering English, decentering world Englishes, where you can get rid of this teleological fallacy that because English in the past was a driver of colonialism, which it was, that doesn't mean that it always has to be that way. If we start to appropriate, instead of language imperialism, it's language appropriation. Appropriation in a positive sense.
Sure. Which is an interesting question. Is this international English, when it's used between different nations, how much of the original culture that produced the language remains?
Not that much. Some, for sure. But like a lot of the slang, a lot of the idioms, they all get moved away and it turns into this communication tool.
Yeah.
It's impossible to completely separate English from its problematic history. And that's something that we also should discuss. It's also impossible to separate Mandarin from the same thing.
Sure.
So the question then becomes for Taiwan, of these two problematic languages, what should we do about the fact that they're problematic, but they're not going away? This is where we get back into linguistic imperialism, where a lot of people think forcing English on people is linguistic imperialism, or expecting people to learn English, or even desiring learning English over one's heritage language, or desiring both English and a heritage language privileges English. And this is linguistic imperialism because it brings in all these cultural things. I would say telling people what they should and should not do is linguistic imperialism. letting people decide, this is what I want to learn and this is how I use it, is the only way to get out of that cycle.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, all right, let's getting back to the bilingual nation by 2030. Now, something that I think, I suspect why a lot of the commentary on Facebook is about it without really knowing anything about it.
Yeah.
Is that there's kind of a cynicism. Over the years, I've seen a million and one of these plans come and go, and the budgets run out. There's a change of administration, and the new administration doesn't prioritize it. And obviously, President Tsai's term will run out in 2024. Even if the next president's from the same party, it doesn't necessarily mean that the incoming team will prioritize it the same way. What is the plan for this going forward? Do they have plans so that it will stay in place until 2030?
I think that the hope is that the programs will be up and running by then, and therefore the funding will be a routine thing.
Okay.
But it's hard to say.
Perpetuating.
Sort of a self-perpetuating, just like every other English programs in the past. There is a question of what is getting funded when? Is the funding appropriate? Is the funding being appropriately used? It's hard to say because despite this being something that has been announced for, I think, over a year now, it's really hard to say where it's going.
Right.
There is a chance that funding, you know, like the next administration will be less interested in this. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think so. I think both parties, they see this as something that is potentially beneficial, possibly for different reasons. Mm-hmm. I think that of all of the people, that Tsai probably is the most thoughtful.
Okay.
To the extent that she is involved, which is probably not very much, but she has said things like Taiwan is a multilingual society. Mm-hmm. Taiwan is a multi-ethnic society. And although that might not be immediately obvious to the eye, it is.
Right.
Whereas you mentioned the Hangulyu plan, I could see that why I want this program to be implemented in a principled way is I don't want it to be kind of half-assed until 2024. And then if the KMT wins and President Ho, not a fan, there's nobody from the KMT I would be a fan of, to be honest, decides he's going to use it to basically to shunt aside all this local language and make it about English and Mandarin.
I think he would be less likely to do that.
Sure,
He's Taiwanese. He's from Jiayi.
Yeah. I'm thinking more about overall KMT ideology, sure, but sure. Yeah.
Something that I suspect is that if the party changes, because this actually happens quite a bit, if there's a program that they think generally is a good idea.
Yeah.
What they do is they rebrand it.
Yeah.
Make a few changes.
Yeah.
And then announce it as their own new plan.
Yeah.
Yes. It's the same thing.
It is.
I mean, a lot of people don't realize how much goes from one administration to another one.
Yeah.
For example, a lot of the initiatives in the 5+2 plan that came in under President Tsai, a lot of it was rebranded stuff from the Ma era.
Yeah.
Which was in turn rebranded stuff from the Chen era.
Yeah.
And it goes back, they rebrand it, sometimes they tinker with the priorities, you know, they up the budget, they down the budget. But a lot of this stuff, it's the bureaucracy that's actually really, because they've got a kind of a technocratic class that both parties inherit, and then they just, you know, run with it, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
There is strong support for something like this among both parties.
Yeah.
So I'm not afraid that it will just disappear. I'm just afraid it could be rebranded to someone else's ends, not necessarily principled.
Right.
Certainly, the only thing I noticed in the media of the KMT directly criticizing it was like their officer of literature and culture or something. Mm-hmm. This was in Chinese. He said in, I believe, UDN, United Daily News, that it was culturally inappropriate or something, while not really acknowledging the fact that his own party has been pro-English for just as long. Yeah. So I'm not that worried about it. I'm worried about whether or not it will be principled.
Sure.
And I worry about that even if the DPP retains the presidency, because looking at a recent tweet from Lai Ching-de, where he...
That's William Lai.
Yep. William Lai. What did he say? Something about, we'll make Taiwan a bilingual nation. And he referenced English and Mandarin. Mm. And I just facepalmed, like, I keyboard faced. I was just like, why would you say that? Because that's not what it's about at all. It says it right in the plan, local language, mother tongue language. And there's such a history of the KMT trying to promote English and Mandarin as the two acceptable languages. Mm-hmm. As a way of marginalizing Taiwanese and other local languages, you can't talk like that if you want to get people on your side. Mm-hmm. But I get the feeling his branding ideas are about 30 years out of date, whereas Tsai is a little more on the up and up, or at least her team is. Mm-hmm. But she's not going to go against him, so she's not going to come in and be like, hey, Will, don't say that. To the extent that she is involved, which I think is mostly she supports it, but it's pretty much Lai's baby.
Yeah.
So I worry more about principles than about it being cut. And again, like you, I worry about stopping and starting funding, which makes it hard to get a program going.
Yeah.
What I can say is, talking to that technocratic class, there are good people. I know them. They are my friends. Mm-hmm. Talking to them about ways to do this in a principled way, trying to get it to be something positive. We need to keep an eye on it, but I do trust the people that are trying to make this a good thing. I think a lot of the commentary about it, and this gets into what bilingual by 2030 is not.
Right.
A lot of people misread bilingual nation by 2030, and they take bilingual a little too literally, which means it's a poorly branded program.
Right.
It really should be called Taiwan a Multilingual Society. Mm-hmm. And that will really bring out this idea of equal promotion of other languages. Otherwise, it's just very easy to put that in writing and then ignore that part. Mm-hmm. And it gets all of the pro-localization critics maybe a little bit more willing to hear your case. Mm-hmm. But also, they think bilingual means making everybody bilingual. It never meant that. What it meant was making Taiwan a country which is accessible in English. But there was never the intention to get everybody to learn it. The idea was to make foreign language learning, whether that's English, another foreign language, a mother language, a heritage language, accessible to those who want it. And there's even language in there about bridging the urban-rural divide, which has been a bugbear of previous plans, which have not addressed it.
Right.
The fact that the language is even in there, it shows that, do I think they're going to make it to their goal of making Taiwan a fully bilingual, accessible country by 2030? No. Do I think that they could get further than previous programs if done in a principled way? Yes.
Okay.
But they really have to talk about it in a way that makes it clear that they do mean accessible. They don't mean making everybody learn English. Mm-hmm. The same with talking about making English an official language. I'm not a fan of that wording. Mm-hmm. They really should just say accessible, like make government information accessible, make starting a business more accessible, make tourism accessible. Signage is already pretty good. Museums, placards, that kind of thing, not as much.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. At least there's often the humorous Chinglish, which makes our day a little brighter.
It does make our... My thing is when there isn't English at all.
Right.
Yes. Like my experience in Tainan, where I had a beautiful museum experience, mm-hmm. in Shijia, where who goes to Shijia? You know.
Stephen Crook.
What tourists coming in from a foreign country go to Shijia? Stephen Crook's friends.
Right.
Yes. But it was so wonderful. And then going to Jiayi and being like, you know.
Right.
It would be great if all of those small museums had at least a bilingual leaflet or something. Mm-hmm. It needs to be an ongoing thing. Someone comes in every few years and makes updates.
Right.
Yeah. That could be a huge positive, I think.
So one final quick question.
Mm-hmm.
If all of the signage is put in English, everything's translated nicely, all the government websites are... then what incentive is there for us to learn Mandarin?
That's a fair point.
I wouldn't have learned how to read otherwise, because there's so much unavailable to me in English. I needed to learn how to read. So.
Sure. I learned how to read Mandarin so I could basically quickly run through newspaper articles. Mm-hmm. I don't like blocking people's way in museums. So if it's in Mandarin, I skim. Mm-hmm. Or I read the headline and I move on. So I didn't learn Mandarin for that reason, because it's annoying to stand in front of a placard and just read something that you read fairly slowly.
Yeah.
I think that those who really want to learn Mandarin are going to learn it even if the museums are bilingual. Mm-hmm. And it would help in terms of tourism. Mm-hmm. Whereas things like people focus on, but the road signs are already in English. Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. But the museums are not.
Right.
Except for a couple of them.
So you can get to the museum, but you'll just be bored when you get there.
Exactly, because there's nothing for you there. And that could really be fixed,
yeah.
I think. Now, this brings in a way forward. How do we do this? I don't want to sit here issuing edicts on how things should be done, because one of my biggest criticisms is people who don't know what the plan is really about, talking about how things should be done. Mm-hmm. So here is how things should be done. It would be one issue with the program when it talks about bridging the urban-rural divide is there is a fairly unimaginative solution, which is they just say, we'll use digital technology. That's a terrible idea. Nobody wants to sit behind a computer to do professional development or for their English class. Instead, I count myself as one of the people who in her own way is working towards this. We, people who are already in Taiwan, already experts, already teacher trainers, already longtime teachers, who have the knowledge and ability to train on a deeper level, go in and do one thing that really works in teacher training is observation cycles. You observe, you give feedback, you work on a development plan, you observe again. You form a community of practice, so different teacher practitioners talk together and improve. And then you come back in a year later to see how things are progressing. Mm-hmm. identify who are the most enthusiastic teachers, the top teachers, whomever, the volunteers to go through this program, get them really, really good at doing this, and then train them to be trainers. Mm-hmm. And we stay on as a advisory role. And then it's totally in their hands and they go out to maybe more rural communities. You have more people able to do that. If we recognize the international certifications that require actual teaching practicum hours, that would be like CELTA, Trinity Cert TESOL, DIP TESOL, Delta, TILEC. These are all certifications that are actually of a good standard. Many of them are recognized by European Board of Qualifications. Recognize them, get local teachers also trained up in them, but then train them to be trainers. Then you can get a whole bunch of Taiwanese who've taken teacher training into their own hands. And then teachers can use that and school districts can use that for their own purposes, rather than let's turn to a bunch of white people and have them tell us what to do, mm-hmm. which I really want to avoid. So a huge criticism I have of the plan is this idea that we're going to parachute in foreigners. Why would you do that when you already have people here who can get this going?
Right.
Bring in some teachers, have a minimum level of qualification for that, but there's no need to double the number of teachers. Mm-hmm. There's no need to parachute in all of these people who don't know Taiwan, don't know the local layout. Maybe they're a math teacher, but they don't know how to do CLIL. Maybe they're an English teacher, but they don't know how to teach a subject. It's not going to work very well. Mm-hmm. Instead, put it into local hands. And finally, really must say, very important, probably one of the most important things I could say, there needs to be a change to the testing system. One of the core findings of Taiwan-based research is that teachers in Taiwan, and there is a bit of an age gap here, under 40, over 40, but generally speaking, they know how to teach in effective ways. They know about task-based learning, lexical, natural, communicative approaches, intercultural teaching, awareness raising, learner autonomy. They know all of it. But then they say, yes, I would like to teach in that way, but I have a class of 50. And they all have to take the Gaokao. They all have to take this proficiency test, that test, the GSAT, whatever. They all have to take these national exams. So all we can do is get them ready. And the national exams are terrible. They've tried to improve them. There is now a listening component. So, but it's still a lot of fill in the blank, multiple choice. It's not communicative. It doesn't test one's ability to actually get one's message across in English, let alone across cultures. And if all the teachers can do is prepare them for that test, this will never be implemented well. So the tests need to either change or go. My vote would be go, but I feel like change is probably the more realistic mm-hmm. thing to shoot for. And then and only then can we really tap into these, especially under 40, but some teachers, you know, at all ages and levels as well, enthusiasm that a lot of teachers actually have for this. I'd say a final issue there is a lot of people criticize it who are not teachers, and they haven't actually asked teachers, what do you think? And you will find critics, but you will also find very enthusiastic people. A good friend of mine, grad school classmate, teaches junior high school in Hsinchu, and she's in her late 20s and says, yeah, my coworkers, especially the ones about my age, are actually excited about this. They're in favor of it. They want smaller class sizes. They want a change. My older colleagues, maybe not as much, but the enthusiasm is there if we can just tap into it. Ask teachers what they want and then find ways to give them that, you know? Ask teachers what they need, find ways to give them that. When teachers say, we know how to teach communicatively, we could use professional development maybe, but we know the concepts. We want to do this. This is what we need to do it. Make that happen and listen to them. When they say, we're interested in this program, listen to them. The professors that I've worked with at various universities, they signed up of their own free will. They're interested. When I've worked with K through 12 school teachers, they signed up of their own free will. They're interested. And I can tell they were not told to sign up because they're actually enthusiastic in class. I think you'll find when people are forced to take a professional development course that
the enthusiasm drops.
Yeah, if they don't want to be there, the enthusiasm drops.
Right.
But it's there, so you can tell they want to be there. So listen to them and do it in a principled way. Fix the testing system. Stop focusing on parachuting in Westerners. Stop focusing on, is this relevant to our culture? Because you could say that Mandarin isn't relevant to Taiwanese culture. You could.
You could.
You could. You could say that when the KMT came in and forced Mandarin on everyone, and when Taiwan cultivated those close ties with the US, that arguably English became as culturally relevant to Taiwan as Mandarin did. Right. You could make that case.
You could.
Someone will probably ding me for that, but you could make that case.
It's a whole other topic, though.
It is. The point is, English, and I want to end with a little story here. Mm-hmm. English is not meant to be something that bolsters local culture, although it can be, because it's another window to see the world. It's meant to help Taiwan engage with the rest of the world while still protecting local heritage. The story I want to tell comes from something I read a while ago that really has stuck with me called Pedagogies of Hope and Resistance. If you've read Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Okay.
No.
He followed that up. Don't worry about it. Followed that up with a Pedagogy of Hope. Didn't really say anything new. Still an interesting guy. Little 70s, but he's fine. So someone did a bit of qualitative research in Palestine and wrote a paper on it called Pedagogies of Hope and Resistance, where they talked about why are Palestinian kids learning English? And many of the answers that they got, or many of the things they heard from learners, are, we want to learn English so that we can tell the world about Palestine. Mm-hmm. One person said, so we can talk to the Westerners, but they meant the wider world.
Right.
I'm sure, as you can see, in the past several years, Palestine has had a bit of a moment in terms of people being like, hey, maybe they've got a point. Maybe we shouldn't just be listening to the Israeli side. Maybe Palestinians have something to say. Let's listen to them. And I think Taiwan could have that moment. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to compare Taiwan to Palestine. I think that there are similarities, but it's not a direct comparison. Mm-hmm. But in terms of using English for one's own purpose, and one's own purpose being talking to other people about regional issues such as Chinese hegemony, talking to the rest of the world about what Taiwan is, the people who want to do that are going to need English, and they should get to decide for themselves who they are. And since research shows that there is not really any detriment to learning multiple foreign languages, you can learn as many as you set your mind to as long as you have the time and put in the work. There's no reason why one has to be to the detriment of the other.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. I think we now know quite a bit about the bilingual nation by 2030. And thank you for joining us in studio here, Jenna.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Be sure to hit like and subscribe and all that good stuff. And tune in for the next show.
This has been brought to you by the Taiwan Report. For more content like this, become our patron at report.tw.
哎呦，就是那个台湾狗啦，最喜欢我的台湾狗了。